Invite you to think with me today in the story of Pentecost and this text where Luke writes, "And all were amazed and perplexed, saying to one another," at the events that occurred that day, "What does this mean?" But others sneered and said, "They're filled with new wine." An Associated Press story reported that police found a burglary suspect dangling from the ventilation system of a convenience store. Deputies said the man removed a ventilation cover, crawled through the vent before getting stuck and setting off a fire extinguisher that sprayed powder all over the store. The man told deputies he was playing hide-and-seek on the roof with other adults. He said the other players couldn't find him where he was, and so they stopped looking for him. One wonders if this man had consumed a few too many adult beverages as he made his plan to rob the store. This is what they said about the disciples on the day of Pentecost. This was, that is, the Pentecost that followed 50 days after that Passover when Jesus had been crucified. The first followers of Jesus, filled with the Spirit of God, spread out all over the temple area and proclaimed to all the good news about Jesus. The gathered throng were Jews from all over the Roman world who had come for Passover worship. The amazing and astonishing part, besides the sound of the rush of the violent wind that had first got everyone's attention, was that each person heard what was being said in their own native language. Some sneered and said, "They're filled with new wine." Now, I would not presume to speak for you, but it appears to me that to be quite a stretch to say that the phenomenon of that day can be explained as the result of the disciples having had too much to drink. Now, if you're watching an NFL football game on a cold winter day in, say, Green Bay or Chicago, you see bare-chested men cheering madly, you can with certainty conclude that alcohol is blunting their body's ability to feel cold. But the events of the day of Pentecost cannot be so obviously linked to alcohol consumption. It was obvious, you see, to all that the followers of Jesus were Galileans, each one of them. You could tell by their accent. And further, Galileans were not known for their ability to master foreign languages. The astonishing thing was that each person heard the proclamation that these Galileans were making in their own native language. People representing many of the world's languages were present that day. What was clear to everyone was that the speakers were not schooled in the languages people were hearing. Some were with a dismissive sneer said they were drunk. Others, many though, knew there something else was going on here. They kept asking one another, "What does this mean?" Then as now, people who sneer at it and say that it means nothing. Last week I was listening to a talk show and the host was interviewing someone who purported to represent atheists and agnostics. Together, they were criticizing the Alcoholics Anonymous organization for their Christian roots and their commitment to reliance on God for help with addiction. They described Christians as those who rely on their big sky friend Jesus. They thought this all fictional, and I gathered the beef was that atheists were somehow marginalized because of the public support of Alcoholics Anonymous. Now, I was not able to hear enough of the program to really understand why they were picking on AA in particular. I heard enough, though, to get my motor running and wish I were in the room to help them understand the folly of their understanding. I mean, first of all, no Christian ever speaks of Jesus as his big sky friend. This is a straw man of their own imagination created so that a light breeze can blow it away. Second, as if they claimed Jesus were fictional, if that's what they really believed, and just a fiction of the Christians' imaginations, why were they so hot and bothered by our purported delusions? Those were just points for starters. I note, though, that Peter's not distracted by their sneering attitudes. In what seems a lighthearted challenge, he offers a brief word in their direction. "Come on, guys, it's only 9 in the morning. The bars aren't open yet." And he invites those who are sneering to consider otherwise, but he doesn't dwell there. He makes no apology and proceeds to declare at Jesus as Lord and Messiah. This is what it means. Peter's audience that day were Jews who knew the writings of the prophet Joel and had a familiarity with the significance of the text he cited, a text that describes what was to come afterwards, that is, as Joel put it, after the coming of the Messiah was how they read that text in Joel. In the last days it will be, declares God. You see, Peter interprets the afterwards of Joel with the Old Testament idea of the last days that were also said to be coming. That is, the days following the Messiah's coming. In other words, Peter is declaring that the last days, as it was understood in the Old Testament, have begun. The Spirit of God is being poured out by God on all flesh, and they shall prophesy, as Joel declared. This is what you're witnessing, Peter boldly proclaims to his fellow Jews. In announcing the last days, Peter is indicating Jesus Christ to be the great pivot on which real history turns. Real history being God's unfolding plan to save and redeem humanity, and along with them, the very creation itself. You might say that the last days represented the final chapter of what we know as human history. In Jesus of Nazareth, crucified and raised from the dead, the first page of this chapter was opened. Pivot. Hinge, final page, first page of the final chapter. These metaphors are only that and cannot fully grasp the magnitude of the moment of history in Jesus of Nazareth. It will only be when our faith becomes sight that we'll start to grasp the fullness of the scope of what this moment means. What we do know, this that Joel could see as coming in the future, is now to be declared because of Jesus. Everyone who calls on the name of the Lord shall be saved. 3,000 said yes to Jesus that day. Many hearing these followers of Jesus that Pentecost day would have been in Jerusalem 50 days earlier for Passover. Talk of Jesus would certainly have brought to mind the buzz in the city that Passover about the Galilean named Jesus who rode a donkey into Jerusalem, into the city, and how the crowds hailed him as the Messiah, and also how he was crucified. But there were other things on that Passover day that were ominous. In citing Joel, Peter includes the section about portents in heaven and signs on earth. The sun will be turned to darkness, the moon to blood, before the coming of the Lord's great and glorious day. What does Peter have in mind? Sir Colin Humphreys is professor and director of research at the departments of metals, science, and metallurgy at the University of Cambridge. And in a recent book of his entitled The Mystery of the Last Supper, he argues, I think convincingly, that Peter has the day of Jesus' crucifixion in mind when he cites that text. You see, first of all, Luke tells us that there was darkness over the land as Jesus was being crucified. Humphreys is not the first to note that what are known in the Middle East as Qasbsin dust storms literally darken the sky. Such sandstorms are common in the spring of the year. Folks, that's when Passover takes place. Second, one of nature's marvels is a lunar eclipse, which has been described throughout history as the moon turning blood red. Humphreys shows how modern scientific methods are able to actually calculate the historic dates on which a lunar eclipse would have been visible from Jerusalem. One of those days was Passover, Friday, April the 3rd, AD 33, which is the most likely date of Jesus' crucifixion. If Humphreys is correct, then Joel's prophecy would have leaped off the page, so to speak, as Peter quoted, in calling to mind natural events that had occurred just 7 weeks before when they were talking, 7 weeks earlier, events that many of the hearers would have witnessed on Passover. We often remark, don't we, of unusual, natural occurring events on annual days of celebration. You know, do you remember the Christmas we got snowed in? You know how we talk about things like that? Do you remember the Passover when there was the sandstorm and then we saw the lunar eclipse? Pentecost was reckoned by Jews to be the anniversary of the giving of the law at Sinai. This is a reasonable deduction from a chronological note that's given in Exodus chapter 19 and 1. When the law was given at Sinai, according to one rabbinical tradition, the Ten Commandments were promulgated with a single sound. Yet it says, all the people perceived the voice. This shows that when the voice went forth, every people received the law in their own language. Now, that rabbinical tradition would have been known to those gathered at Jerusalem that Pentecost day. So here they are now, on the reputed anniversary of the law-giving. And people from every nation under heaven heard the declaration about Jesus, each one in the native language of each. You see, a moment akin to the significance of Sinai has occurred in Jesus. The living Word of God has been given. Indeed, as John wrote in his Gospel, the Word became flesh and lived among us. The Word of God has been promulgated in a single life, Jesus of Nazareth. Now, if the giving of the law was a seminal moment in God's dealing with humanity, then Jesus is that even greater moment, as he is the very fulfillment of this law. You know, the day you were given your name by your parents, that was an important day in your life, wasn't it? I mean, the force of being named that day has import throughout your life. It is on every piece of identification you have to show that you indeed own the particular car you're driving or a particular piece of property. That you were named with the name you have has a particularly important force on the day a deceased parent's last will and testament is executed. You see, the force of a moment in your personal history, the day when you received your name, is not diminished because it occurred way back in your personal history, so to speak. When the story of the day of Pentecost is read in the 21st century, we're prone to wonder what to make of its significance for us today. We more readily know what to do with Christmas and Easter. Pentecost, not so much. The force of this day continues now, though. The Spirit of God, God's effectual presence and power, imbues the church to be the witness of Jesus to our world as the first disciples were to theirs. When the faithful Jews heard the law being read, it was heard as God speaking to them personally. Even though Sinai was a point in history long past, the force of that day continued. In a similar way, the force of the day of Pentecost continues. The Spirit is being poured out on us so that we can declare as well, everyone who calls in the name of the Lord will be saved. You know, last week, our missionary friend, Reg Reimer, was in Saigon, celebrating the 100th anniversary of the Christian and Missionary Alliances Church, their first sending of missionaries to Vietnam to preach the gospel. Reg and his wife, Donna, went as missionaries for that denomination and arrived in Vietnam in the 1960s, the mid-60s, and they served there up until the fall of Saigon in 1975 when foreigners were forced to leave. I once sat with Reg sharing a meal in a Vietnamese restaurant in downtown Toronto. Reg knew the restaurant owners while in Vietnam. It was quite an experience to see this thoroughly Canadian, somewhat Mennonite-looking man order our meal in fluent Vietnamese and catch up on the comings and goings of their family in that same language. It seems to me that his ministry is a continuation of the force of the day of Pentecost. There was a sound of a rushing wind that Pentecost day, marking the Spirit's presence. Now, the word wind, or spirit, or breath, is the same word, that's translated from the same word for our Hebrew foreparents. Breath in Hebrew denotes creativity. The breath of God that God breathes into his own people is that movement of God upon us and within us, which enlivens our creativity and frees it for service in God's kingdom. Where the Spirit is concerned, creativity has nothing to do with extraordinary artistic talent. The creativity of the Spirit, rather, is simply the freeing up, the magnification and multiplied usefulness of any gift we have in order that this talent might now be used for God's purposes among those near and far. The Spirit, or breath of God, fosters and frees up such creativity as, and only as, we first decide to do something. In congregational life, drawing up a list of talents in the congregation can be helpful, but may lead us to conclude that we can attempt only those things for which we have demonstrable talent. It's never, it seems to me, a congregation's responsibility to sleuth out what it thinks people can do and then tell God that this is the range of the Spirit's breath.
It's always our responsibility to discern what the king and his kingdom require and resolve to do it. We find out we're supplied with what we need as we reach to do. Often people discover talents they didn't know they had as they attempt to do things in obedience to God that they see need to be done. If you think, for example, that our congregation needs to give attention to youth, then perhaps you could lend yourself and your efforts just to do that very thing. Think of the wonderful talents you might discover that you have in yourself as you reach forward for such a thing. The point I would invite you to take with you is this, that the force of what God did on the day of Pentecost has not been rescinded. The power to serve Jesus is as much ours as if you and I were present that day with those disciples and people heard our halting voice in with its dialect and accent, and they heard it in their own native language. All were amazed and perplexed, saying to one another, "What does this mean?" May we answer with Peter, "Everyone who calls on the name of the Lord shall be saved."